I wondered if you've ever entered a competition, not just any competition. I'm thinking of the kind you might see, I often see it in a kids' magazine, and I'm thinking back to when I was a child myself and I saw these competitions. It would have a big picture of some wonderful toy or set that you could win, and it said, you know, answer this question below to win this prize. And so you look at the question, you think, oh great, I've just read the answer to that question in the sentence above. So I know the answer, so I can enter this competition and I'm going to win. It's fantastic. After you've done it a few times, you realise that lots of people do this and it's just a prize draw, and actually you don't really win this toy. The scope, if you like, of this competition, the breadth of this competition is much smaller than you originally envisage. At the opposite end of the spectrum, think about PPI insurance. Let's call it the PPI kingdom. Now, when the banks devised this ploy of charging people for this payment protection insurance, they wanted to make their kingdom, their PPI kingdom, as big as possible, because the more people they could get signed up for this kind of policy, the more money they could rake in. So they were thinking, oh great, you know, we want the scope of this kingdom to be large. Now, it's backfired on them now, because we find every time they're announcing financial results, they're having to take money off their profits and say, we're setting aside all these billions of pounds to pay out to people who had PPI. And actually, if you're somebody who thought, actually, am I part of this? Did I take out this insurance? I'm not really sure. There's all these adverts, aren't there, encouraging you to find out whether you were part of this PPI kingdom. And it's good news, isn't it? If you ring up and you find out that actually, yeah, I'm part of this PPI kingdom. I can get some money back. Isn't this wonderful? But when they were planning it, they wanted to make it as big as possible. And it's now backfired on them. Now, the reason I mention these two examples is just because we're thinking really about the scope or the breadth of God's kingdom. Okay, that's what we're thinking about tonight. The first example was to show you actually the scope of the prize winners in that prize draw is very tiny. Now with the PPI insurance, the scope of all the people who took it out, like the banks don't like it now. They don't like the fact it's costing them money that the scope of that kingdom was large. Well, what's just happened in Mark's gospel is that Jesus has had an interaction with the Pharisees, and it's over this ritual of hand washing, and Jesus rebuked them really because they were setting up artificial boundaries regarding who is in God's kingdom. They were thinking the scope of God's kingdom is small. There's a special select group of people who are living our lives in a way that God likes. So that is the scope of God's kingdom. But now what Mark is doing through this account of Jesus going into Gentile areas, he's showing us the full extent of the reach of God's kingdom. And it's much broader than the Pharisees thought. It's much broader than anyone thought, really. And we learn that though the Messiah has specifically come to Israel, we learn that his mission encompasses Gentiles too. And that blessing for Israel actually means blessing for the entire world. The entire world. So what do we see in these Gentile areas? Let me just explain how we know that. Chapter 7, verse 24, we read, Jesus left that place and went to the vicinity of Tyre. That was a Gentile region. Look up in verse 31. Jesus left the vicinity of Tyre and went through Sidon, down to the Sea of Galilee, and into the region of the Decapolis. Now, this was the area where he'd cast out the demons into the pigs. Okay, if you remember that from when we covered that in Mark. And then at the beginning of chapter 8, the phrase during those days, i.e. those days in which he was in Decapolis, a large crowd gathered. So all these three incidents are things that happen in Gentile areas. And we actually learn that the need that Jesus encountered when he was with the Jews is exactly the same needs that he encounters when he's in Gentile areas. And the first need, the first extensive need we see is that there is spiritual darkness. Spiritual darkness. Verse 25. As soon as she heard about Jesus, a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an impure spirit came and fell at his feet. The woman was a Greek, born in Syrian Phoenicia. She begged Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. The woman's daughter is demon possessed. She's a little girl, a little child, and she is possessed by a demon. Now this terrible occurrence is not something that's restricted to Gentile areas. It did happen in Israel too. But obviously the woman is clearly distressed. This little girl was not herself. We know from other accounts in the Gospels about the kinds of things that demons did, the kinds of harm that they carried out on people. So they were often not able to control their own actions. Maybe shouting out uncontrollably. Sometimes the demon would throw the individual into situations of danger, to fire or water. So when we read the accounts, it says someone is possessed, but the actions are often done by the demon themselves. So we often read phrases like the demon shouted out or the demon overpowered them. Now, how terrible would it be to see your own daughter in that situation? I mean, it's horrible to see your child in danger as a fault of someone else, isn't it? But watching this in your own child, it would have appeared as if it was the daughter herself putting herself in these situations of danger. I mean, as a parent, you can imagine that distress. This is a great need, isn't it? This is a great need. Child. The only thing that close I could think of was like when you see your child with a high fever. They're so sleepy, they're so lethargic, they don't seem like themselves. That's what's most distressing. They don't seem like themselves. Where has my child gone? But in this situation, this isn't a disease, this is a personal tormentor. A demon. And the mother is desperate. And she begs Jesus. She falls at his feet. As soon as she hears that he's in the town, it was tried to be kept a secret. Said he could not keep his presence secret. As soon as she heard about him, this woman fled to Jesus. I wonder what would you turn to in that situation? A doctor? Maybe in that culture you would turn to a local priest in whatever temple was in your town. All those options would not have solved her problem. The woman and her daughter needed Jesus. They needed Jesus. So there's spiritual needs, spiritual darkness. There's also physical need. In the second account, verse 32, we learn about some people who bring to Jesus a man who was deaf and could hardly talk, and they beg Jesus to place his hand on him. So the crowd in Decapolis, they want Jesus to heal this deaf and mute man. And the fact that he could hardly talk suggests that he'd never really learnt to form words properly through listening to others speak. So it suggests he'd had this this deafness right from birth. Now maybe sometimes you might wish you couldn't hear. Maybe you wish you could have a bit of peace and quiet. Just sit in a corner by yourself and not have any loud noises. But actually, for this man living his whole life like that, it would have cut him off from relationship completely, wouldn't it? It was likely that someone like this wouldn't be able to work. They would be illiterate, limited to sign language. And gestures. They couldn't hear instructions from other people. They couldn't hear words of love from other people. He couldn't express those things himself. Maybe it was his friends who brought him to Jesus. Whoever they are, they obviously care for him. They have a deep desire for him to be healed. This isn't just a beggar whom nobody cares about, with whom they have no connection. And who else could he have gone to? There was no medical aid that could diagnose a condition and prescribe medicine, no National Health Service. This man would have been a burden to his friends and family, a mouth to feed, but not able to work. And they couldn't fix his problem. This man needed Jesus. There's further need. There's a desperation for teaching. A desperation for teaching. Look at verse 37. People were overwhelmed with amazement. He has done everything well, they said. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. During those days, another large crowd gathered. Now, these large crowds, they're following Jesus. They were amazed at him. It's understandable, isn't it? His arrival in this area couldn't be kept secret. The word about Jesus had already spread. We learnt that earlier on in Mark, how people all around were talking about this person doing wonderful things. Who is he? What is he doing? By whose power is he doing these things? His words have authority. These crowds were desperate to see him, to be healed, to hear his teaching. Now, this particular crowd had been following him for 3 days, and they've got nothing to eat. And that's what it says in verse 2. I wonder whether you've ever got so taken up with something that you don't even make any plans to eat. Maybe it's work. You're getting so stuck into it that you don't even think, oh, the shop's going to close at 10 o'clock, so I need to stop now and get my food. Your mind is so into it that you don't even think about the food that you need to get to next. These people, they hadn't forgotten to eat. It's that they hadn't planned to be following Jesus for 3 days. So they hadn't even taken that provision with them. But they were so captivated by him and his miracles and teaching that food itself becomes a much lower priority to them than listening to Jesus. And here was someone who could speak the truth. Earlier in Mark, we're told that Jesus spoke like no one else before. Not like the Pharisees, not like the teachers of the law. These people following him know they need to hear his words and listen to his teaching. And this crowd in the Gentile area, they have no source of truth. They weren't Israelites. God hadn't declared his law to the Gentile people. God hadn't chosen for Jesus to be born into a Gentile nation. They hadn't been given the promises of the Messiah. They hadn't heard these things. And these were the lands that were living in darkness. They had no sacrificial system, no temple by which they could see the promises of a Saviour to come. If the Israelites were in desperate need of a Saviour, how much more the Gentiles? These people needed Jesus. There was extensive need. Now, whilst we see that Jesus was primarily sent to Israel, because most of the accounts of the Gospels take place in the land of Israel, in front of Jewish people, what we learn through these verses is that the entire world needs a Saviour. And that's what we still see around us today, isn't it? We do see great spiritual darkness around us. It might be people getting mixed up with the occult. Maybe even if people aren't getting involved at that level, they still might live their lives without reference to God, spiritually adrift. And when there's rejection of God and his ways, then any kind of so-called wisdom or guidance can come in and fill that gap, take the place of God's wisdom. There's great physical need as well in the whole world, isn't there? I listened to a podcast about healthy eating. Different episodes are called Eat for Your Eyes or Eat for Your Skin, how to improve your health. There hasn't yet been an episode called Eat to Stay Alive. Okay, that's, you know, that's taking it a bit too far, isn't it? You can't actually find some foods that will keep you alive. Health deteriorates. There's an episode on eating to help cancer. And really all they can say is, well, just improve your health a little bit whilst you're going through cancer. We can't overcome these illnesses, can't we? Can we? And ultimately, we can't overcome death. We have no power over it. We experience it. We see it in the people around us. I've had many colleagues just this year who have lost loved ones or have loved ones who are very sick at the moment. And I'm sure people that you speak to, people you know on your street, they're either going through this at the moment or very soon they will be. It's in living memory. It's very close to people's hearts. All kinds of suffering like this. We see unbelievers around us experiencing it, or maybe family members, and we see in them a yearning for it to be gone, don't we? A yearning for it to be solved. That's why people want to eat healthily. That's why people search for some fix to get rid of these things. Today, we might say people are not necessarily longing for the teaching of Jesus, though some are. But people are longing for wisdom. There's millions of articles, books and blogs written to give people wisdom how to live. How to live their lives in the best way. How to be successful. How to be rich. How to be loved and liked. How to be popular. How to be famous. People are looking for answers. They're not looking in the right place, like these people were in following Jesus. But the longing is there. The longing is there. And that's why it's so helpful when we can talk to these people about Jesus. We show them how he makes sense of life, how he makes sense of our lives. We show them that difficult things still hurt, but that we can trust the God who rules this world. And we can show them that Jesus' kingdom has reached even us, so it can reach them too. There's extensive need in the world around us. The second thing we see in these Gentile regions after the extensive need is expressive faith. Expressive faith. And I've called it assertive. Actually, I took that word from Tim Keller, assertive. Now, what's this conversation about dogs? Okay, so let's read it. The woman comes to Jesus and she begs for Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. And he says, "First let the children eat all they want," he told her, "for it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." "Lord," she replied, "even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." Then he told her, "For such a reply you may go. The demon has left your daughter." She went home and found her child lying on the bed and the demon gone. Now the Jews, they would sometimes refer to the Gentiles as dogs, or Gentile dogs. And they weren't meaning a nice pet dog, but a dirty creature that you don't want around. The image you need to have in your mind is a stray dog, maybe the kind of dog that has scars on it. It's the dog that you would tell your children not to stroke, and actually to stay away, because you don't want them to get contaminated by this dog. That's what they meant when they referred to Gentiles as dogs. People you avoid. Now Jesus is actually the one who brings it up first, isn't he? He's saying that he has come first of all to the Jewish people. That's what he means by the children. They are his first priority. And that's what we see happening in the Gospel of Mark. The majority of events occur in front of Jewish people. The times that Jesus is in Gentile territory is small, and he sometimes speaks to just individuals from Gentile lands. So what Jesus is doing here is he's questioning this woman to find out who she thinks he really is. And her understanding, her answer shows that her understanding is far better than that of the disciples. She says, "Even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." So she's saying, just like we illustrated with the children, in the process of children eating, it's inevitable that dogs get fed. This Christmas, we're having Claire's family to stay with us. That includes their dog called Wilson. We gather around the table to eat together. When eventually he stops cowering in the corner in fear of crackers, he'll wander under the table because he knows that under there's going to be food for him. Because even if we're not trying to give him food, there will be food ending up on the floor. And we spend the whole meal, wondering who we're touching under the table. And it's actually, the dog running around trying to eat up all the food. That's what dogs do. It's inevitable that on Christmas Day, he will eat some Christmas dinner. Because when the children are fed, there's crumbs, there's excess, and the dog gets fed too. So this woman recognizes that for the Messiah to come and bless Israel inevitably means that there's blessing for the whole world. That's what she's saying. She doesn't deny that she should be called a dog. You see, she actually acknowledges that she's not a worthy recipient of God's blessing. And yet, the way she pleads with Jesus is on the basis of his goodness and not her merit. She knows that she can have confidence to ask Jesus because the way he blesses is in abundance. It's in excess. And so she wants to be blessed too. Tim Keller calls this rightless assertiveness. Rightless assertiveness. She has no rights to assert, yet she can confidently ask for blessing because she knows that the blessing that Jesus brings is abundant. So, faith that's assertive. Also, faith that's simple. You see, the absence of any personal merit or contribution to what Jesus does is also seen in the deaf and mute man. Look in verse 32. There some people brought to him a man who was deaf and could hardly talk, and they begged Jesus to place his hands on him. It's the friends who beg on behalf of the man. He has no words of his own to speak to Jesus. All he can do is follow, is to be led by his friends, is to be led away by Jesus. I'll read 33 and 34, and just listen to all the active verbs. They're being performed by Jesus. After he took him aside, away from the crowd, Jesus put his fingers into the man's ears. Then he spat and touched the man's tongue. He looked up to heaven and with a deep sigh said to him, "Ephphatha," which means "be opened." The only thing the man himself did was to use the voice that Jesus had now given him. He began to speak plainly. And in fact, he uses his voice to tell people about Jesus. So, simplistic faith. He followed. He followed his friends. He followed Jesus. And he was just a subject of Jesus's blessing. But, sadly, we also see a lack of faith. And this lack of faith is not in the Gentile people. This lack of faith is in the disciples. Let's look at verse 4. So these people are following Jesus. And Jesus says, "I don't want to send them home. If I send them home hungry, they will collapse on the way because some of them have come a long distance." His disciples answered, "But where in this remote place can anyone get enough bread to feed them. Now, we've been in this situation before, haven't we? And the reader is meant to think, is it not obvious to the disciples who Jesus is and what he can do? Where can we get any bread, Jesus? You know, you fed 5,000 people last time, but where can we get any bread this time? Maybe they're not quite as dull as that, and they're actually thinking, okay, you did it in the Jewish lands for the Jewish people, but obviously you're not going to bother for these Gentile people. Let's just send them home. But I think it's more that they are dull. Jesus certainly thinks so. If you look ahead to verse 17 and 18, this is what we'll be looking at next week. This is after the feeding of the 4,000, and they're going back in the boat, and they're talking about, well, Jesus says, beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod, and they're confused about the discussion. They're saying, oh, it's because we have no bread. And Jesus says to them, why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see and ears but fail to hear? Jesus is saying to them, look, you haven't got it. You haven't fully understood. And their failure to see the identity of Jesus at this point in Mark's gospel is now in stark contrast with these Gentiles that Jesus has just interacted with. And we are meant to be reading this and thinking, how can they not see it? It's so obvious. See, Mark's intention through this part of the gospel is to drive the reader to faith in Jesus by making the reader think, even I can see who Jesus is. Even I can see what Jesus can do for these 4,000 people. We should be amazed that the blessing of Jesus' kingdom reaches to those who are unworthy. Because that includes us, doesn't it? That includes us. Isn't it right and correct to say that we have no merit to claim when it comes to receiving the blessing of God's kingdom? What claim could we make? Maybe we might say, well, my family have always been Christians. I've always gone to church. I've a long history as far as I can remember. Maybe you might claim your behavior is what qualifies you to receive the blessings of God's kingdom. Maybe you look around you at other people and think, well, I'm not like them. I'm not like that person who did this, who did that unkind thing, who committed that crime, I didn't speak that word. That's the way the Pharisees thought, wasn't it? We're not like them. We have no claim. We have no right to claim the blessings of God's kingdom. But should this stop us from asserting our faith? Should we shrink back from God because we feel our sin is too great for him to handle? No, we mustn't shrink back, because that would be to misunderstand God's goodness. I have a quote here from Tim Keller, and he is quoting John Newton. There's some words from him, from Keller first, and then a letter that John Newton wrote. There are two ways to fail to let Jesus be your saviour. One is by being too proud, having a superiority complex, not to accept his challenge. But the other is through an inferiority complex, being so self-absorbed that you say, I'm just so awful that God couldn't love me. That is not to accept his offer. John Newton once wrote a letter to a man who was very downcast. This is what he says. You say you feel overwhelmed with guilt and a sense of unworthiness. Well, indeed, you cannot be too aware of the evils inside of yourself. But you may be, indeed you are, improperly controlled and affected by them. You say it is hard to understand how a holy God could accept such an awful person as yourself. You then express not only a low opinion of yourself, which is right, but also too low an opinion of the person, work, and promises of the Redeemer, which is wrong. It's one thing to express a low opinion about yourself, but to do that about God is to diminish his character. God's mercy reaches into the deepest pit of sin and pulls us out. I don't know if you've ever accidentally dropped something into a bin. Maybe it's a toy that you're having to pull out for someone else. Depending on how valuable you think that toy is, determines how far you put your arm down into the bin. Do you go right to the bottom? Right to your shoulder? Maybe it depends what's in the bin. Is it the food waste bin? Or is it just the recycling bin? Well, God's mercy is so rich and full that he reaches into the deepest pit of sin to pull us out. Just like we sang, didn't we, about our worth has been set at the cross. That's how deep he reached down to pull us out. So we need to remember that no matter the need of the people we meet around us, that God's goodness and mercy can reach them. They don't need to merit it. They cannot merit it. You never merited it. God reached down to you and lifted you. So, the third thing we see in this Gentile region, after the extensive need and the expressive faith, we see excess provision. Excess provision. How did Jesus respond to their need? Jesus shows compassion. We see it in each of these encounters, don't we? The woman. The result of their interaction is that the woman goes home to find her daughter back to herself again. Imagine those words in verse 29 being spoken to you. For such a reply you may go. The demon has left your daughter. Imagine how fast she ran. Jesus grants her request. She receives all that she asked for, didn't she? All that she asked for. This is the time of year when Christmas lists are written. Has anyone here ever received everything on their Christmas list? I doubt it. I think one year Tom showed us Katie's Christmas list, and it was a rather long list. Well, this woman, she asked Jesus for her daughter to be released from the power of the demon, and that's what she got. Everything she asked for was given. How wonderful. This man, just look at how Jesus treats this man incredibly personally. Now, the way he released this little girl from the demon, all he says to the woman is, the demon has left your daughter. He doesn't even need to speak a word of command to the demon that is recorded here. He doesn't need to go to her house. The demon has left her daughter. But with this man, this deaf man who's spent so much of his life isolated from people, not able to relate to people. And Jesus comes to him. He could have merely spoken and the man would have been healed. He didn't even need to speak. He could have thought it and the man would have been healed. But what does he do? He takes him aside, away from the crowd, privately. He touches him. He touches his ears. He touches his tongue. He speaks to him in a way that that particular word would be visibly seen by the man. Jesus' lips moving when he mouthed the word, be opened. See, Jesus is communicating to this man in a way that he understands. He's saying to him with his gestures, I'm going to fix your ears as he touches them. I'm going to fix your tongue as he touches it. And a man who's probably suffered the stares of many throughout his life is taken out of their gaze and made to look on the one who can remove all his troubles. At this, the man's ears were opened, his tongue was loosed, and he began to speak plainly. What does he use his new voice to do? To tell how wonderful Jesus is. He's commanded by Jesus not to tell anyone. But the more Jesus does that, the more the people keep on talking about it. So that people are saying, yes, he makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. He's not just given a voice to relate to his friends and his family, but a voice with which to praise his God. And then look at the crowds. Look at the crowds. Jesus has compassion on the crowds. I have compassion for these people. Verse 2. They have already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. He knows that to send them away would result in them collapsing, and he will not be responsible for that happening. They began with 7 loaves and ended with 7 basketfuls of leftovers. So they left with more at the end than what they started with. That would be like passing the bread round tonight and finding that at the back it's a much bigger loaf than when it started at the front. You see, if they wanted to stay following Jesus and listening to his teaching for another 3 days, he could have provided for their needs, couldn't he? This is excessive provision. Excessive provision. So, can Jesus meet the needs of these Gentile people? Yes. Yes, absolutely. Excessively. Abundantly. Can Jesus release people from the grip of spiritual darkness? Can Jesus open the ears of someone to really hear his teaching for the first time? Can Jesus loosen somebody's tongue to tell of his greatness for the first time? Can Jesus provide for the needs of his followers so they go on listening to him? What do we see happening in this part of Mark? We see a Gentile woman coming to Jesus begging for crumbs. What do we see at the end? Thousands of Gentiles fed and satisfied with bread and fish. So it's not just crumbs that are left over, but basketfuls of remains. Who is it who comes to the table and receives all they want? Look at verse 27. First, let the children eat all they want, he told her. It's the children who come and eat all they want. Jesus is treating these Gentile people like children, like part of his family. He's welcoming them in. Jesus shared a meal with his disciples. It's the meal that we'll celebrate together tonight. Who does he invite to share that meal? How big is the gathering? How wide is the invitation? He invites those who are needy. He invites those who have nothing to offer themselves. He abundantly provides. And when Jesus invites you to his table, he's saying, you were once far off. Not part of God's blessing, not deserving of God's blessing. But come in, pull up a seat, be a child in my family, eat your fill and be satisfied. And he can say that because Jesus was the child who became like a dog, cut off, cast out from God's favour. The wrath was poured on him, so that we can receive abundant forgiveness. Forgiveness for every sin. For every sin. In the Book of Common Prayer, there's some words written by Thomas Cranmer many years ago, and it's a written prayer as people are about to take the Lord's Supper. But it says this: "We do not presume to come to this your table, merciful Lord, trusting in our own righteousness, but in your manifold great mercies. We are not worthy so much as to gather up the crumbs under your table, but you are the same Lord whose property is always to have mercy." That's the God that we come to. That's the God that we worship. That's the God who has poured out his blessing upon us. Let's pray.